march south in a wide detour to the east to avoid the communist ambushes which the faithful cricket spotter planes already had reported to him along the Pabi track. His progress was slowed by the fact that his column contained women and children. Nevertheless, on December 17th, their subgroupment had reached Pukhoi, about midway between Lai Chau and Dien Bien Phu to the southeast. There, it received another airdrop of supplies. Thus far, contact with the enemy had been limited to sporadic encounters with what seemed to be enemy scouts. Hope increased that Ulpat would reach nearby Laos, where a relief column of Laotian mountaineers and French commando forces under Lieutenant Colonel Vaudrey was clawing its way through the jungle in the direction of the light companies. But on December 18th, at 10:00, a murderous mortar barrage, followed by swift infantry attacks of Viet Minh regulars and pro-communist tribesmen, shattered that hope. Within a few hours, subgroupment Ulpat had ceased to exist. Lieutenant Ulpat, 5 French non-commissioned officers, a Thai lieutenant from the 301st BVN, and 6 tribesmen found each other after wandering in the jungle for 4 days. They were spotted by French helicopters from Dien Bien Phu on December 22nd and picked up at 1700. Subgroupment Guillemie had been under constant attack since December 8th and never succeeded in shaking the enemy. Faithful to his mission of defending as long as possible the approaches to Lai Chau, Guillemie and his 7 companies hung on grimly to Panham Pass. Finally, under intense mortar and rifle fire from the surrounding heights, Guillemie requested permission to make a last stand on Pitompara, Paratroop Hill, 2 miles northwest of the pass. The permission was granted, but too late to save Guillemie and his men. Under violent attack for almost 2 days, the force was overrun on December 10th at 09:10 by a communist reinforced battalion. 1 French sergeant, Ariscot, and about 150 men succeeded in breaking out from the massacre and reached Muang Thon, 14 miles south of Lai Chau, on the afternoon of December 11th. What the gallant Sergeant Ariscot did during the next 7 days deserves a whole book in itself. Muang Thon had become the rallying point of the remnants of every light company in the area, with the result that Ariscot soon commanded a 600-man force, which, according to its size, should have been commanded by a major. He diligently organized an airdrop of supplies, succeeded in getting a helicopter for 5 serious casualties he had been carrying with him, and led his force to the south without stopping. It is surprising that the French army, which was to maintain helicopter contact with the Ariscot force to the end, never thought of lightening his command burden by bringing in some higher-ranking officers. Ariscot kept driving his men south. His aim was to catch up and rendezvous with the Ulpat force at Paukhoi, but the constant pressure of communist units made his column's progress an endless agony. At 1600, December 15th, Sergeant Ariscot reached Muang Cha under heavy fire. A new isolated company, the 546th, and 40 men from the 547th joined his column, but only for a short time. The communists, like hungry wolves attacking the stragglers of a caribou herd, pounced on the newcomers during the night and destroyed them. It had now been 4 days since the Ariscot force had received its last airdrop of supplies. The men were exhausted from hunger and thirst, as Ariscot made known on December 16th in a laconic radio message. A rendezvous was made for an airdrop on December 17th in the afternoon at a clearing near Ban Nam Cha. By now, the Ariscot force was a mere day's march behind the slower-moving Ulpat force. As the sergeant's battalion established its bivouac at Ban Nam Nie on the evening of December 18th, the harassed men re-established radio contact with the base at Dien Bien Phu, only to receive the shattering news that the Ulpat force had been crushed and that their most direct road to the south was already sealed off. At 21:30, there was a brief message from Ariscot that he was under attack. However, a message from GMPT-1 at Dien Bien Phu ordering him to turn around and head northwestward into Laos apparently was never received. When a French reconnaissance plane flew over the battle area on the following day at 1600, it suddenly spotted Ariscot and a handful of men. They were still armed, and they still carried a radio. The spotter plane gave them a rendezvous point for the next day, where they could be picked up by helicopter. Ariscot agreed that he would be there, and disappeared into the jungle after a last wave at the circling aircraft. He and his men were never seen again. Sergeant Blanc's group, comprising the 416th, 418th, and 428th Light Companies, as well as the remaining headquarters elements of GMPT-1 and dependents from the 301st BVN, never had a chance. Encircled at Muangpong, 70 kilometers south of Lai Chau, the subgroupment was constantly under heavy attack. 5 wounded were evacuated by helicopter in the afternoon of December 11th, and Sergeant Blanc attempted to push the women and children southward in the direction of the rescue forces from GAP-2, which were fighting their way northward against strong opposition. Blanc failed in his attempt. The 3 companies disappeared completely in the course of communist attacks during the night of December 12th to 13th, 1953. Only subgroupment Vima was lucky. Pushing resolutely eastward into enemy territory rather than westward into the expected pursuit area, the 431st, 432nd, and 434th Light Companies, with the 434th under Master Sergeant Comte making its way separately from the main column, arrived at Hill 836, 6 miles northeast of Dien Bien Phu, as early as December 15th, and reached the valley without further losses. Other dispersed units had varying degrees of luck. The 388th Company received orders on December 12th to fall back to Partisan Pass. It sought to reach Laos via the Nam Yuk Valley. On December 14th and 15th, it received airdrops of supplies and orders to march in direction of Dien Bien Phu. The order was acknowledged, and the little band was seen changing directions. It disappeared during the night of December 16th to 17th and was never heard from afterward. The Thai Mule Transport Company and the 248th Light Company had better luck. Already en route southward when Lai Chau fell, they passed through Muangpon before Sergeant Blanc's subgroupment was encircled there and arrived at Sop Nam on December 16th, where they found a survivor of one of the commando forces of the 8th BPC and some escapees from the destroyed garrison of Muangpon. Until then, the Mule Company had dragged along its faithful beasts. But during the night of December 16th to 17th, the path the unit had chosen, and wisely, for it led them in a wide swing around the Muangpon battle area, became so abrupt that the mules had to be abandoned. On December 18th, the Mule Company and the 248th emerged from the deep jungle and established radio contact with Dien Bien Phu. An airdrop of emergency supplies permitted the starved survivors to regain energy for the final trek. They arrived in the valley of Dien Bien Phu on December 22nd. The agony of the Pollock's force had not taken place in isolation. In fact, it was to become a first test of the ability of Dien Bien Phu to play its contemplated role as a mooring point for deep offensive stabs, a role whose importance had been underlined once more by a new director from General Cogny on December 8th. The operation involved pushing the whole reinforced GAP-2 to Muangpon, one-third of the way along the Pavi track to Lai Chau. This was no minor operation, since it involved the 1st BEP, the 5th BPVN, all the remaining elements of the 8th BPC, and 2 batteries of 105mm howitzers. The force also had 1 Cricket reconnaissance plane and 4 B-26 bombers at its disposal. The force was alerted on December 10th at 16:30 and left the valley at 0200 with Touré's 8th BPC in the lead. 8 hours later, at 10:00, Touré reported that progress was slow but normal. This report was confirmed by the spotter plane. Nevertheless, at 11:30, just as Touré's lead elements penetrated the seemingly abandoned village of Bon Tau, deadly accurate infantry fire suddenly erupted from the surrounding hills. With practiced speed, the paratroopers fanned out into a defensive perimeter and began to engage the invisible enemy. Within a few minutes, the 8th BPC had suffered 11 casualties. It slowly began to hack its way toward a hill which would give it a better defensive position should the enemy decide to rush the small force. The newly arrived Long Lei joined the column astride on his pony, but the latter soon had to be abandoned when it proved unable to advance on the narrow paths hacked out of the jungle. Grimly restraining his pain, Long Lei gave a first lesson in leadership to his new command. Holding on to an enlisted paratrooper and to Lieutenant Singlon of the Heavy Airborne Mortar Company, he hobbled along with his troops for the rest of the whole mission. In the meantime, at 15:30, the Muangpon garrison under Sergeant Blanc, hard-pressed by the enemy, kept calling for an early breakthrough of the rescue forces. It requested napalm on the surrounding enemy positions. The advance of the bulk of GAP-2, however, had ground to a complete halt. With Toure still pinned down on his hill, the GAP-2 made preparations for an all-around night defense. Beginning its progress again at 0300 of December 12th, the bulk of GAP-2 reached Toure at 1400 against light enemy opposition. But in order to avoid falling into yet another ambush of the type which had held up the 8th BPC, the whole GAP-2 now took to marching along the hill line running parallel to the Pavie track. While militarily a sound solution, it proved physically agonizing. The hill line was totally covered by 6 to 9 foot high elephant grass, which had to be cut with machetes. In full battle gear, with no sources of water within reach, the paratroopers hacked their way forward at a rate of 200 yards an hour. Many of them collapsed from the effects of dehydration. Grimly, the men marched on throughout the night of December 12th to 13th, spurred on by the radioed pleas of the hard-pressed garrison of Muang Pon. On December 13th at 0800, and with Major Leclerc's 5th BPVN in the lead, the GAP's march on Muang Pon continued, this time within earshot of the battle for Muang Pon, where Sergeant Blanc's depleted Thai light companies were still holding out. But there remained an agonizing 4 kilometers to cover at the cost of thousands of machete blows against an almost impenetrable wall of high grass. As the noon hour approached, the fire at Muang Pon suddenly began to die down. A few minutes later, the little reconnaissance cricket confirmed the bad news. Sergeant Blanc's gallant little garrison had been overrun. The village was in flames and apparently crawling with Viet Minh regulars. Nonetheless, the GAP pushed on in the hopes of being able to rescue some of the survivors. It was again the paratroopers of Toure who were in the lead. When they reached Muang Pon at 1400, its ruins were deserted, save for the bodies of the Thai tribal soldiers who had fallen. The survivors and the civilian population had been carried away by the departing communists. Toure and his men fell back on the main column at 1530, having found no survivors. There was yet another act in the dramatic attempt at rescuing the light companies. The 4 earlier dispatched commando groups of the 8th BPC, reinforced with 1 company of the 3rd Thai Battalion, had, upon the news that the garrison of Muang Pon was in desperate straits, hacked their own way through the jungle east to west from their raid on the road to Tuan Xiao. They had remained in radio contact with the 5th BPVN and had also reached the Muang Pon area at almost the same time as the vanguard of Captain Toure. They had learned by radio that the garrison at Muang Pon had succumbed. The paratroop commandos, fleshed out with tribesmen who were native to the area, truly showed what an elite force could do, even under trying physical circumstances. In contrast to the sluggish progress of the paratroopers of GAP-2, who were hauling along on their march everything from medium mortars to 105mm howitzers, and who were not accompanied by native Thai tribal forces, the mixed Thai and paratroop force had approached Muang Pon in harrowing forced marches. They, too, had to hack their way through the jungle with machetes. Instead of being able to follow a ridgeline, they had to walk across several ridgelines, whose valley bottoms were often 2,000 feet below the crests. For 3 days in a row, they kept moving for 17 hours a day, only to be faced with the heartbreaking fact that the whole effort had been in vain. In fact, one of the last ironies of the situation was that some of the commando elements had come across the path of advance of GAP-2 and, thinking it newly hacked out by the advancing Viet Minh, had thoroughly mined it. When the 8th BPC was apprised of the fact that the Vietnamese paratroops of the 5th BPVN would have to use the pass for their withdrawal, Sergeant Benzek, who had placed the mines, had to turn back and undertake the dangerous job of defusing his own booby traps. While the attempt at rescuing Muang Pon had failed, the battle was far from over for the 2nd Airborne Group. Major Leclerc's and Captain Toure's spearhead forces had barely begun their withdrawal southward when at 1650 their column was raked by heavy enemy fire. As the report of GAP-2 was to show later, the Viet Minh had succeeded in installing its heavy weapons within 500 yards of the last nighttime bivouac of the paratroopers' weapons. They were undetected by both French aerial reconnaissance and the paratroop patrols, and they were able to blanket the paratroopers with utmost precision. Within a few minutes, the paratroopers were taking heavy losses and calling for an airstrike by the B-26 bombers, which were at their disposal. The prompt intervention of the bombers probably saved the 5th BPVN from almost total destruction. Even so, the battalion's losses were serious, 3 dead, 25 wounded, and 13 troopers missing. This was not the end. The communist forces, no longer held up by the roadblock of Muang Pon, now began moving in on the whole airborne group. On December 14th at noon, the howitzers began firing in support of the rearguard elements of the GAP-2 formed by the paratroopers of the 1st Foreign Legion Parachute Battalion, BEP. As on the previous day, the Viet Minh sought to close in with their target as rapidly as possible in order to avoid the destructive strikes by the French Air Force. At 14:50, the 1st BEP reported that it was heavily engaged in hand-to-hand fighting with communist regulars. Again, the French Air Force intervened, this time getting a foretaste of what fighting would be like at Dien Bien Phu. At 1500, one of the reconnaissance crickets reported that it had been hit by enemy anti-aircraft fire, and at 1600, one of the fighter bombers reported hits. The Legionnaires, in the meantime, were taking a serious pounding. When the enemy finally broke off the attack at 1830, the 1st BEP had 24 wounded and 28 dead and missing to report. It also had lost a great deal of equipment. 4 automatic rifles, 12 submachine guns, 1 30 caliber machine gun, and 3 radio sets. The 5th BPVN lost another 3 dead and 20 wounded in its last clash. On December 15th at 0735, the last elements of GAP-2 re-entered the valley of Dien Bien Phu. Its first raid in force and reconnaissance in depth had ended in failure. In addition, the destruction of the Thai light companies had shown that it was almost impossible to maintain any kind of regular units behind communist lines in the face of determined communist clearing operations. As the situation now developed, the forces at Dien Bien Phu had ceased to be a mooring point for offensive operations within 1 week after the fall of Lai Chau. It was equally obvious that heavy paratroop forces were not the ideal tool for this sort of operation. On the other hand, small raiding parties or guerrilla units such as Touré's commandos or the GCMA Cardamom Force were unable to inflict upon the enemy the kind of damage that would prevent it from carrying out its major strategic intentions. For such small forces to become truly effective would take months, if not years, of political preparation of the terrain. This the French had failed to do when there was time for it. Now it was too late. 5 years' neglect could not be repaired in a few weeks. There now remained the task of adding up the losses of the past week of mobile operations. When the Pollock's force had set out from Lai Chau on December 9th, it numbered 2,101 men, including 3 French lieutenants and 34 French enlisted men. When the last survivors of the Thai Mule Company and the 248th Light Company reached Dien Bien Phu on December 22nd, a total of 10 Frenchmen, including Lieutenant Ulpat, and 175 tribesmen were accounted for. Almost 2,000 armed men and several hundred civilian dependents, along with 2 French officers and 14 sergeants, had disappeared on the trek. In addition, the communists had captured enough weapons to arm a regiment. In his hard-hitting post-mortem of the operation, the newly arrived commander of the GAP-2, Lieutenant Colonel Longley, noted the incredible ability of the enemy to camouflage his gun positions and camps so as to render them invisible to aerial observation and ground reconnaissance. In contrast, Longley noted, the French paratroopers would establish their bivouacs without much concern about camouflage and, like any rich Western army, would drop along their path empty cigarette packs and ration containers to leave a track like Hansel and Gretel for communist patrols to follow. This first serious setback, remarkably enough, it received almost no publicity whatever, seemed to have made no impression on the French Northern Command in Hanoi, which had been responsible for the conduct of the battle. With Lieutenant Colonel Longley in the lead, despite his barely repaired ankle, the GAP again made for the hills at midnight of December 21st, 1953. Not that the 8 intervening days had been spent by the airborne group in idle rest and recuperation. On the contrary, it had been busily engaged building the headquarters bunkers of Dien Bien Phu, and the 5th BPVN was hacking out the brush about 3 kilometers northwest of the airfield around 2 small hills which were to become later Strong Point Anne-Marie. The terrain which the second reconnaissance raid was to traverse was, if anything, even more difficult than that encountered on the attempt to reach Muang Pon. Moreover, Even if it succeeded in reaching the French Laotian forces of Major Vaudrey, the mission would have no tangible after-effect. Neither Vaudrey nor the garrison at Dien Bien Phu had sufficient troops to spare to make the link-up permanent. In addition, to make the jungle track between Dien Bien Phu and Sop Nau, the nearest Laotian town, accessible even to light vehicles, would have been a feat of road engineering that could not have been dreamed of under prevailing conditions. To give but one practical example, it took the United States Army in nearby Burma nearly 18 months to build the famous 120-mile-long Lado Road, and that without enemy interference and with all the engineering equipment that American ingenuity could muster. The 50-mile-long jungle track between Sop Nau and Dien Bien Phu was cut by deep ravines, crossed a 6,000-foot-high mountain range of sheer limestone cliffs, and was located hundreds of miles away from the nearest French heavy equipment bases. The engineering aspects of the problem alone were nearly insoluble. When one considers that such a road would have to have been built in the face of constant communist attacks by full-fledged regular divisions, the futility of a ground link-up with Laos, for other than psychological reasons, to prove that Dien Bien Phu was not hopelessly sealed off from the outside world, was obviously futile. The operation had a double code name, Ardèche, a French department known for its deep valleys, for the forces coming from Laos, and Regatta, for Langlais forces coming from Dien Bien Phu. The Ardèche force was composed of the 5th Battalion of Laotian Chasseurs, commanded by Major Vaudrey, and the 5th Moroccan Tabor, commanded by Major Coquelet. The whole force was commanded by Major Vaudrey. Ardèche had begun only a few days after Operation Castor, and had involved a harrowing 200-mile march in the face of constant harassment by Laotian pro-communist Pathet Lao guerrillas. It was also known that all of Battalion 920 of Viet Minh Regiment 148 was awaiting the Ardèche force at the key river crossing of Muang Qua. Muang Qua had already been the site of an epic battle during April and May 1953, when the French ordered a light Laotian battalion to make a last stand there in order to gain time for the defense of central Laos. Now, the roles were reversed. Battalion 920 was holding fixed positions, and it was the French and Laotians who were on the offensive and in the jungle. They reached the heights overlooking Muang Qua on December 3, 1953. The Viet Minh, who had been expecting the attack for days, were ready to receive them with well-dug-in automatic weapons, preset mortar aiming points, and even minefields, quite probably the same the French had left behind when they were overrun 6 months earlier. The combined Laotian-Moroccan-French force pressed on. By 1630, it had captured a key hill overlooking the main positions, and the battle became a carbon copy of the earlier one, except that for once the communists and not the French were cornered into defending a fixed position. The 920th was a solid force and grimly held on throughout the whole next day in the other two bunker positions. Its last survivors escaped across the Namo River during the following night. A lesson could have been learned here for Dien Bien Phu. There is little point in defending a fortified position if adequate firepower and personnel are not available to beat off the assault force. This lesson had apparently been learned by the communists after Muang Qua. It was not learned by the French. With Muang Qua solidly in hand as a rear base, the Ardèche force was ready for its final dash towards Sop Nau, where it was to meet the paratroopers from Dien Bien Phu. This force consisted of the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Foreign Legion Regiment, which reached Muang Qua after a forced march of 21 days, and looked, according to one observer on the ground, like concentration camp inmates. Its young doctor had lost 22 pounds. Several men are dying of typhus. The trek to Sop Nau, although only 25 miles away, proved miserably difficult. As the path led across an almost uninhabited mountain chain, no water was available, and the men chewed leaves from the opium poppy flowers to still their thirst. There was also one French woman in the force. She was one of the top combat reporters in the Indochina War, with a splendid record in the French resistance movement during World War II. Mademoiselle Brigitte Friang had been parachuted to the Ardèche force before it reached Muang Qua, and was to follow the whole operation on foot all the way to Dien Bien Phu. On December 21st, the force reached Nyana Song, a bare 8 miles from Sop Nau. As communist forces were reported in the area, the Moroccans of the 5th Battalion set up a defense perimeter around it, while Vaudrey and the Laotians made the final dash for Sop Nau. The small airstrip at Nha Nau Song had been completely destroyed by the Viet Minh, who had made the population construct dikes across it. Throughout the night, in the light of the burning vegetation, the Moroccans flattened out all the obstructions on the field with picks and shovels parachuted to them at 2100 by the supply aircraft. Colonel de Castries, who desired to be on hand when the Ardèche and the Regat forces met in the middle of the Laotian jungle and in the presence of previously flown-in newspaper men and camera operators, landed at 1400 on the following day on the small strip in his own cricket liaison craft. One last firefight with the retreating communists still awaited Vaudreuil and his Laotians as they entered Sap Mau. A rearguard force of Regiment 148 had laid an ambush across the path. It had to be destroyed with mortar fire and gunfire from the 57mm recoilless rifles that had been painfully dragged along through the jungle. But at noon on December 23, 1953, Major Vaudreuil and Lieutenant Colonel Longley shook hands in front of the cameras in the middle of Sap Mau. For public consumption, the myth that Dien Bien Phu could become the mooring point of freewheeling raiding forces had been established. The paratroopers of the 8th BPC and 1st BEP, who had reached Sap Mau with no incident other than the repeated crossing of deep icy rivers with all their equipment, looked somewhat bedraggled in their dripping wet uniforms. Their last bivouac had been at Hue Hun, 3 miles from Sap Mau, but across yet another river. The return to Dien Bien Phu was even worse than the approach march. Unseasonable rains had fallen, and the already swift mountain rivers were even harder to cross. Christmas was spent in wet uniforms in the middle of the jungle. Because large elements of Regiment 148 were now reported in the surrounding area, Lieutenant Colonel Longley had decided to follow a new path, and airdrops of additional supplies were forbidden in order not to give away the new route of the Regat force. The path became so impracticable that it was decided to destroy part of the heavy equipment. A Legionnaire paratrooper had his arm torn off when a sabotaged mortar exploded prematurely. He was evacuated by a helicopter which also brought in an American journalist, Dixie Reeds, who was to follow the last 2 days of the march to Dien Bien Phu in a business suit with a pair of American loafers on his feet. Finally, on the morning of December 26th, a cry went up among the lead elements of the column. Dien Bien Phu. The valley had finally been reached. But the Viet Minh gave the returning force a last reminder of how closely it had been shadowed. As the French crossed the last hill line in full view of the fixed positions in the valley, an isolated rifle shot was heard, and one of the paratroopers crumpled in a heap. He was to die a few hours later. As the exhausted paratroopers stumbled into camp, Brigitte Friang noticed a Christmas tree in front of one of the dugouts, a tree that might have come straight out of Goya's disasters of war. The trunk was a pole used to hang barbed wire. It was crowned with an enemy helmet and carrying for ornaments a well-worn GI boot, empty bottles, and smashed cans of army rations. Thus ended the last deep penetration of French forces from Dien Bien Phu into the hinterland. In his official report written on the following day, Longley showed that he had no illusions as to the possibility of regular communications with the nearest friendly post in Laos. "The jungle is so thick," said Longley, "and the terrain is so fragmented that to establish a straight-line connection between Dien Bien Phu and Sap Mau, for example, would in all likelihood take several months." This left the French High Command in Hanoi and Saigon with two choices for Dien Bien Phu. One of them was to recognize that the valley could never play its role as a mooring point for offensive operations. Where such operations were feasible, they could be carried out by the infiltrated commandos of the GCMA or by much stronger forces, such as those of the Ardèche type, whose operations were similar to those of the British and Americans in Burma in 1942-44. The other alternative was to construe Dien Bien Phu's role as that of becoming a center of attraction for strong communist forces at a point far away from the most sensitive French targets in the Red River Delta, while they were being readied for the major 1955 campaign which Navarre had originally envisaged. As it was, the French did neither. Extensive raiding operations were continued, bringing few results in terms of intelligence and being extremely costly in terms of human losses. At the same time, no all-out effort was made to put Dien Bien Phu's fortifications in shape to withstand a major communist assault. long-range reconnaissance operations of the Regat and Pollux type left the participating units unable to fortify their positions. The reconnaissance missions continued, although they now were limited to the immediate environs of the valley. How close the enemy now was became clear when De Castries's chief of staff, Lieutenant Colonel Guth, was killed on December 28th by 18 Tommy gun bullets during a patrol only a few hundred yards north of Strong Point en Marie. On the following day, parts of Major Paul Pegot's 3rd Battalion of the 13th Foreign Legion Half Brigade, 313 DBLE, opened the road beyond the village of Bon Him Lam only to run immediately into heavy resistance, and on December 30th, the 2nd Moroccan Battalion, pushing southward from Strong Point Isabel, ran into enemy opposition at the village of Bon Kang, 5 kilometers to the south. Again, the French suffered losses. But the High Command thought, and this turned out to be a correct assumption, that the heaviest attacks would come from the northwest, along the road from Tuan Xiao, from which the bulk of the communist supplies would have to come. Therefore, De Castries decided to push the whole 8th BPC as far along the road toward Tuan Xiao as it could go without encountering heavy enemy resistance. To make the mission even more fruitful, the 8th decided to follow a route across the mountains, so as to bypass, if possible, a communist roadblock or outpost likely to exist in the little town of Ban Na Loi, 4 kilometers north of Strong Point Beatrice. Some of the tribesmen still living in the valley had been taken along to serve as guides, for they had said that they knew which path should be taken by the paratroopers. Yet when the column entered the jungle on the afternoon of January 6th, there began a great deal of inconclusive marching to and fro. The guides began to disagree as to which path was to be taken, and finally admitted that they had forgotten the exact path. Captain Touré decided to hack his own path northward, and the column emerged the following day on Road 41 north of Ban Na Loi. The 8th had barely reached the road when it was greeted by an intensive barrage of well-aimed infantry fire. The well-trained paratroopers rapidly took cover and then counterattacked. They lost only 5 wounded and were able to capture a wounded Viet Minh soldier. All 6 casualties were loaded on stretchers, but the Viet Minh prisoner and one of the wounded Thai died 2 days later when almost within sight of Dien Bien Phu. With their presence now discovered, Touré felt that the chances of progressing further were slim, and he ordered the return of the battalion via Ban Na Loi. As expected, Ban Na Loi was held by the Viet Minh, who met the French column with mortar fire. Touré finally called for airstrikes from Dien Bien Phu in order to break the roadblock. The fighter bombers reduced Ban Na Loi to a shambles, and the 8th BPC returned to Dien Bien Phu on January 8th at 1200. It had again failed in its long-range reconnaissance mission, although it had once more clearly documented the fact that the communist siege ring was tightly wound around the valley and was getting tighter by the day. Undeterred by these reverses, De Castries kept on trying to fulfill his primary mission of offensive mobility. On December 13, 1953, he had written to General Cogny to ask him for a minimum of 12 battalions, with which he could simultaneously control a battlefield of 40 square kilometers while being able to launch reconnaissance in force and raids with effectives of about 3 battalions. Hanoi indeed did its level best to improve De Castries's manpower position by relieving some of the least reliable or most fatigued units, such as the 301st BBN or the 2nd Moroccan Tabor, and replacing them with better troops. Yet this did not improve the results of the offensive stabs outside the valley. A raid carried out on January 12, 1954, on the village of Ban Hoi Phuc, 3 kilometers southwest of Isabel, by all of GAP-2, yielded nothing but some more casualties. A massive attack was once more led by the much-harassed GAP-2, reinforced by the 3rd Battalion of the 3rd Foreign Legion Infantry Regiment against Hill 683, a communist position within 2,000 yards of Strong Point Gabriel. It lasted from January 31st to February 2nd, 1954, and for the first time ran into strongly fortified communist positions. The advancing troops saw nothing until they suddenly were fired on almost directly from under their feet. The Viet Minh, incredibly successful masters of the art of camouflage, had built bunkers directly into the ground and underbrush. Their firing slits, hardly wider than a mail slot, barely revealed themselves, even when the bunker crews used their weapons. Resistance had become so strong and knowledge of the terrain so essential that Longley decided to include in his task force the 2nd Thai Battalion, BT, of Major Maurice Chanel. The 2nd BT, which the year before had fought with distinction in defense of the northern part of the Thai territory, its home area, had shown a distinct decline in combat morale since it had arrived in Dien Bien Phu. Chanel, a foreign legion officer who knew the Thai uplands well, was aware of this. He requested time to take his battalion in hand again, but felt that he could not refuse an order to participate in a sortie. On February 1st, with the primary mission of finding and destroying enemy artillery positions and bunkers already a failure, parts of 2nd BT found themselves in a rear guard position when, at 15:30, heavy communist fire enveloped the platoon of Lieutenant Negre. Within a few minutes, 17 tribesmen and Lieutenant Negre lay dead on the battlefield. Only a rapid turnabout of the paratroopers saved the 2nd BT from annihilation. While the losses in men were serious, a more ominous stroke of bad luck attended their death. Lieutenant Negre had carried with him on that raid a large-scale map of the valley of Dien Bien Phu, which had just been completed by the French army from the most recent aerial photographs. With the map in their hands, the communists were able to adjust their artillery fires with utmost precision. The Viet Minh artillery, until then more often talked about than actually seen and felt on the battlefield, no longer was a myth. On January 31st, the mountain ring around Dien Bien Phu had echoed for the first time with the sharp bellow of American 75mm pack howitzers and 105s bombarding the Dien Bien Phu airstrip and strongpoints Elian and Dominique. An aircraft parked on the strip was damaged. French combat aircraft intervening in the ground battles, as well as the lumbering transports that landed in a steady stream on the dust-covered airfield, also experienced something that until now had been a rarity in the Indochina War, communist anti-aircraft artillery. A few days later, French intelligence identified the enemy as the 45th Artillery Regiment and the 367th Flak Regiment. As of February 6th, until the actual outbreak of the battle on March 13th, the primary mission of the reconnaissance elements was to destroy the communist artillery, which to all appearances was invulnerable to counter-battery fire from the increasingly large artillery available to the French at Dien Bien Phu. The B-26s and Bearcat fighters, with their rockets, bombs, and napalm canisters, proved equally ineffective. The very size of the sortie elements involved, they often comprised more than half of the total garrison, indicated the high priority the French commanders now assigned to the problem. On February 6th, Lieutenant Colonel Longley and GAP-2, the 2nd BT, the 1st Battalion of the 4th Moroccan Infantry, a Foreign Legion flamethrower detachment, and a platoon with explosive charges from the 31st Engineering Battalion, assaulted the highest mountain in the immediate vicinity of Dien Bien Phu, Hill 754781. Though the target was located 4 kilometers due west of Dien Bien Phu, the Longley task force used Road 41 as far as Ban Him Lam, and then turned southeastward. Longley left the 1st BEP at Ban Him Lam in reserve to cover the withdrawal of his task force. For 8 hours, progress was smooth. The enemy seemed to have evaporated, and by 11:15, the Moroccans of Major Jean Nicolas had almost arrived at the crest of 781. Contrary to the widely accepted myth that only the paratroopers and the Germans of the Foreign Legion fought the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the Moroccans had acquired a solid reputation as road openers. They regularly exercised this specialty on the dangerous part of the Pavi track between Dien Bien Phu and Isabelle, 6 kilometers to the south. This explains why on a dangerous mission such as this, they formed the lead element of the stab. It became obvious that the artillery, contrary to expectations, was not on the reverse slope of 781, where, according to the artillery manuals, it should have been, but was probably on the forward slope facing Dien Bien Phu. Once this had been ascertained, the Longley task force began to move forward again. Immediately, it was hit by a communist infantry counterattack as violent as it was sudden. At 1300, 3rd and 4th companies of the Moroccan battalion were hit, and at 1345, the attack engulfed the already mauled 2nd BT. But the Moroccans were undeterred. Sergeant Laksin Benklifi of 1st Company, despite heavy enemy fire from automatic weapons, immediately led his squad in an assault on the high ground on Hill 781 and held it long enough to permit an orderly withdrawal from the murderous trap. Captain Girard and his third company also held in spite of heavy losses. Sergeant Comte and his platoon held off two communist attacks, while Comte himself dragged back the body of Master Sergeant Pierron. The acts of individual heroism were many that day atop Hill 781, but few equaled that of Private Mohammed Ben Miloud, who, seeing two Viet Minh soldiers drag a wounded Moroccan into the jungle, jumped from his cover, killed the two enemy soldiers, and dragged the wounded man back with him. While the Moroccans held, the Thai tribesmen of 2nd BT were virtually disintegrating and had to be sandwiched between the Moroccans and the paratroopers of GAP-2 to be kept in line. At 18:20, the order came to fall back to Ban Him Lam, and at 30 minutes past midnight, the exhausted Lung Lay task force returned to camp. It had accomplished nothing, but had lost 93 men, including 3 officers and 12 sergeants. The 1st Moroccan Battalion, 14 RTM, alone, had lost 1 dead, 50 wounded, some of them to French artillery shells which had fallen short, and 5 missing. One wounded company commander, the Moroccan captain, Fassi, was to die on February 11th. On February 9th, an infantry task force comprised of foreign legionnaires of the 113 DBLE and 1st Battalion 2nd Foreign Legion Infantry, 12 REI, a company of White Thai and a mixed company of the 14 RTM, explored Hill 273 at Ban Hong Lech Kang, about 5 kilometers due west of Dien Bien Phu. As it approached the deserted village, the lead unit was met by a well-developed paratroop company easily recognizable by its distinctive French camouflage uniforms. The fact that the unit was made up exclusively of Vietnamese was not surprising either. After all, each of the Foreign Legion and even of the mainland French paratroop units had been yellowed up to 50% of its strength. That the task force had not been notified of the presence of other friendly units in the area was also not surprising, since each day one strong point or another would send out local reconnaissances, or foragers, to find construction wood for bunkers and trenches. This was what made the first volleys fired by the communists wearing French camouflage uniforms, probably captured from a misdropped airborne cargo load, so murderous. It was fortunate that there were no paratroop units on the French side, and they therefore were wearing jungle green instead of camouflage dress. Otherwise, in the confusion, the French forces would have shot at each other. Even so, the engagement degenerated into hand-to-hand combat at 12:30. At 1600, reinforcements had to be called to permit the disengagement of the reconnaissance forces, who returned to camp with 7 dead and 21 wounded. From that day onward, reconnaissance outfits were issued distinctive strips of colored material torn from the parachutes. A specific color was worn around the left or right arm by all troops participating in a given operation. Enemy intelligence was so good, however, that even this measure did not entirely eliminate traps of the kind which had occurred at Ban Hong Lech Kang. The main danger to the French position was to come from the dominant hill lines to the north and northeast, occupied by the enemy's 308th and 316th Divisions, and, on January 23rd, by the 304th Division. Frantically, the 12 French battalions dug in to withstand a first assault, which French intelligence announced for January 25th. Contrary to expectations, however, the enemy attack did not materialize. Instead, the 308th Division left the siege ring and made yet another stab deep into Laos in the direction of the royal capital of Luang Prabang, just as it had done in the spring of 1953. In fact, both de Castries at Dien Bien Phu and General Navarre in Saigon feared that the Viet Minh had altogether abandoned the idea of attacking Dien Bien Phu head-on and would bypass the strong point just as it had bypassed Na San 1 year earlier. On January 29th and 30th, 1954, the French High Command ordered de Castries to undertake further powerful reconnaissance missions, and on February 2nd, Navarre and his chief advisers in Saigon felt so certain of the enemy's change of intentions that they recommended to General Cogny that the garrison of Dien Bien Phu be reduced to 9 or even 6 battalions. Cogny objected firmly to that idea, and argued that even with the departure of the 308th Division, the enemy retained a 2-to-1 manpower superiority over the French garrison. Moreover, the repeated failures of the reconnaissance forces to break out from the tight siege ring laid around the valley by the communists augured ill for a reduction in the size of the forces stationed there. The alternative would have been total evacuation of the valley. This was the reason the communist forces held on to all their observation posts on the high ground around Dien Bien Phu. On December 25th, the French had intercepted a message sent by the forward element of the Viet Minh Forces Intelligence Services to the Communist High Command. It contained the following significant passage. If we let the enemy pull out without noticing it, as happened at Nasan, we will bear the responsibility for it before the political general delegate of the army. Retrospectively, this gives the Battle of Dien Bien Phu new dimensions. The first battle lost was that of the long-range penetrations designed to dislocate the enemy's rear areas. The second battle was now underway. Its design was to dislodge the enemy from his dangerous northern and northeastern lookout posts, from which the whole valley and the so essential airfield could be constantly watched. The French were now in the process of losing this battle. On February 10th, Longley's GAP-2, reinforced by a company of the Algerian 57 RTA under Lieutenant Botella and Major Pigot's 313 Foreign Legion Battalion, once more attempted to clear Hill 674, 1,200 yards east of Gabriel. By 10:00, all progress had stopped in the face of heavy enemy resistance from excellently camouflaged bunkers and trenches. Artillery fire was called for. It came promptly, but fell far short of its targets and landed in the midst of the advancing French force, killing 15 Algerians. For the time being, this stopped the attack in the direction of 674. In the meantime, another prong of the same operation sought to clear once more the ever-tightening encirclement around Strongpoint Beatrice. A light battalion formed from the 9th, 11th, and 12th companies of the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Algerian Rifle Regiment, 33 RTA, under Captain Jean Garandeau, reinforced by the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Foreign Legion Infantry, 33 REI, under Major Henri Grand-Desnon, attempted to clear the hill line to the southeast of 674. The 33 RTA had been continuously in Indochina since November 1950 and had participated in the difficult clearing operations north of Saigon until 1952, when it had been sent to fight its way through the infamous Street Without Joy. It had gone directly from there to the Plain of Jars in Laos to fend off yet another communist offensive, and thence to North Vietnam, where it had suffered severe losses in clearing operations in the Red River Delta early in December 1953. As its diary noted tersely, the battalion had had 10 days of rest in the 5 months prior to its transport to Dien Bien Phu. On January 30th, one of its outposts east of Strongpoint Dominique, commanded by a French sergeant, had been mysteriously wiped out by a communist commando, leaving only one Algerian survivor. At Dien Bien Phu, the 33 RTA was considered an outfit whose long battle experience had, through wear and tear, turned into battle fatigue. The 33 Foreign Legion, on the other hand, was a solid battalion, composed largely of Germans, but with some Italians, Spaniards, and Yugoslavs. Two of the company commanders were named Rossini and Gatti, and a third company was commanded by Lieutenant Alain Gambiez, the son of General Navarre's chief of staff. There was also a Lieutenant Raiko Cibic and Sergeants Bagnono, DiBiase, Jorge Saez, and Ahmed Subasik. The Algerians and the Legionnaires ran into a heavy ambush along the northwestern approaches to Hill 781 at 1315 on February 11th. Within a few minutes, the Algerians lost 18 men. Again, the communist positions seemed invisible under the deep canopy of trees and thick underbrush. The 3rd Foreign Legion Battalion also suffered heavy losses, and at 1700 the order was given for both units to fall back on Ban Kachit, a small village about 2,000 yards south of Beatrice and due west of 781. The 9th and 12th companies of the Algerian battalion covered the withdrawal under heavy fire and lost another 11 men and one field radio set in the process. In the meantime, Longley's men, thrust against 674, also had stalled in the face of enemy small arms and artillery fire. On February 13th, the reinforced airborne group once more slashed forward, but this time behind a carpet of bombs laid down by B-26s, which had flown in from Hanoi. While the actual results of the airstrike on the communist positions was almost nil, it gave the French forces the needed boost in morale for yet another push forward. In bitter hand-to-hand fighting, in which no quarter was given, and French, Vietnamese, and North African lives were lost each foot of the way, the Longley Task Force finally cleared Hill 674, as well as Hills 633, 632, and 626, destroying each of the well-camouflaged communist blockhouses and bunkers with flamethrowers and explosive charges. Yet even this partial victory was hollow, for it had been won at the price of heavy losses and the temporary commitment of everything moving within the garrison. Hill 674 was so far removed from the main centers of French strength that its permanent occupation, or rather the securing of supply and communication lines between it and the rest of the valley, would have been too costly to contemplate. Nevertheless, the repeated failure of the French before 781, which was even closer to the vitals of the fortress than 674, might in the end prove fatal. There, the hard-pressed Algerians and legionnaires had received orders to fall back to Road 41, since it was obviously impossible for two weary battalions to take a strong position defended by the better part of a communist division. The withdrawal itself proved a delicate matter, and required help from the newly constituted French tank squadron, whose 10 vehicles, as will be seen later, had laboriously been put together by hand in the middle of the battlefield. On the evening of February 15th, de Castries called off the whole operation, and the Langlais task force returned to the valley. That evening, an agonizing stock-taking was in progress at de Castries' headquarters and in Hanoi. According to the latest statistics provided by Dien Bien Phu, the losses incurred by the garrison amounted, from November 20, 1953 to February 15, 1954, to a total of 32 officers, 96 non-commissioned officers, and 836 enlisted men, or about 10% of all the officers and 8% of all the troops available in the valley. In other words, the French had lost the equivalent of one full battalion of infantry and the cadre of two full battalions. These losses did not include those of the Pollock's force. It was up to General Cogny in Hanoi to make up for the losses, since they were suffered in his command. On February 17th, he made the fateful decision that henceforth, attacks launched by the Dien Bien Phu garrison would be limited to light reconnaissances, to be carried out by commandos made up of restricted amounts of personnel. The order made quite clear that it had been given in view of the losses incurred, whose importance is without any relation to the ascertainable results. This decision came in the wake of two other developments, each of which was minor, but which had impact on the development of this crucial phase of the battle. On February 4th, the French 4th Bureau, Supplies, in Hanoi, had informed Dien Bien Phu that it would have to reduce its overall ammunition consumption rate in view of the attack of the Communist 308th Division on Laos. On February 6th, General Cogny sent a personal directive to de Castries, informing the latter that his depleted ammunition stocks would remain that way for another 8 days, in view of other priorities. Thus, the offensive stabs against Hill 674 and 781 had been sparingly supported by the French artillery, and almost no artillery fire was available to pounce on the communist artillery positions when the latter were being installed, and were thus relatively vulnerable. With the loss of the battle for control of the heights around Dien Bien Phu, the last raison d'etre of Dien Bien Phu had evaporated. The slash of the 308th Division to within 20 kilometers of Luang Prabang, and the simultaneous stab into central and southern Laos by the 325th Division and one regiment of the 304th, amply demonstrated that Dien Bien Phu had lost its last shred of usefulness. In Hanoi, General Cogny's sharp-eyed Deputy Chief of Staff, Lieutenant Colonel Deneff, had clearly recognized the situation 1 month earlier, and had written in a short and brutally frank note for his commander, "It is too late to throw the machine into reverse gear. To break out, we would need 4 battalions to act as rear guard and 4 battalions as flank guards, and they would be by and large offered up for sacrifice. Since the 3 Thai battalions are unusable for such a mission, we would have to sacrifice the bulk of the force to save 4 battalions, 3 of whom would be Thai. That battle will have to be fought on the scale of the whole Indochinese peninsula, or it will become a hopeless retreat." In transmitting this report to General Cogny, Colonel Bastiani, the Chief of Staff, added a note of his own, which was deeply significant. "I fully agree. In either case, it will have to be the battle of the Commander-in-Chief. I think he must have foreseen the necessary requirements before letting himself into that kind of hornet's nest." This was the ultimate excuse of a staff officer. The situation was hopeless, the action taken made no sense, but there might after all be a higher reason for all of this. "The Führer must know what he is doing." This phrase had been repeated 100 times over by the German defenders of Stalingrad as they senselessly fought on toward catastrophe. The same rationale now began to prevail among the French senior commanders as they contemplated developments in the faraway valley. Even the small commando reconnaissances confirmed what now was known to everybody, that Dien Bien Phu was tightly encircled by a vise of at least 4 communist divisions. Nevertheless, de Castries did not altogether give up the idea of powerful reconnaissance stabs. After all, he had been entrusted with the command of the valley precisely because of his predisposition for offensive operations. Thus, on March 4th, a mixed force of Thai tribesmen of the 3rd Thai Battalion, Major Leopold Timonier, and of the 5-7 Algerian rifles of Major Roland de Mecanien from Gabriel, sought to dislodge an enemy force which had entrenched itself a bare kilometer north of Gabriel on Hill 633. As might have been expected, the French force was almost immediately caught in a crossfire of well-camouflaged enemy weapons and had to withdraw with heavy losses. On the following day, the 1st BEP under Major Maurice Guiraud once more attempted the deadly climb of 781. It might as well have saved itself the trouble. Major Guiraud's battalion found the enemy heavily entrenched almost all the way to Road 41 and around 3 sides of Strongpoint Beatrice. On March 6th, General Cogny once more warned Colonel de Castries against losing too many men in costly reconnaissance missions. Finally, on March 11th, 1954, Lieutenant Colonel Langlais, for the last time, led the 2nd Airborne Group on a large-scale reconnaissance. The objective was not the communist forward supply base at Tuan Xiao, nor even nearby Sopnau or Muang Pon. It was only Hill 555, 2 miles away from the center of the fortress. Here, the enemy was digging trenches in open daylight, directly overlooking Hill 506, on which Beatrice was located. GAP-2 could not even make a dent in the communist positions. At 1700, it began to fall back to Dien Bien Phu, carrying its dead and wounded with it. The Battle of Dien Bien Phu was exactly 48 hours distant. 4. Siege. While Longley's paratroopers and the infantry battalions of the perimeter were fighting the last phases of the battle for the hill line, a struggle of a different sort was going on in the depths of the valley. As was shown earlier, the French High Command had realized only belatedly that Dien Bien Phu would have to be organized defensively. Like the other phases of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the battle to fortify the valley was going to be lost in Hanoi and Saigon. And this defeat was not, as commonly supposed, in the field of intelligence or aerial supply, or even in that of artillery, but in combat engineering. As long as Dien Bien Phu was considered a guerrilla mooring point, the preparation of permanent field fortifications had been kept to a minimum. Until December 4, 1953, the 17th Airborne Engineering Company had concentrated on making the airfield usable for cargo aircraft and rebuilding the wooden bridges connecting the airfield with the town of Dien Bien Phu and Route 41. At the same time, each of the battalions of the original landing force had dug some sketchy defensive positions in a narrow perimeter around Dien Bien Phu. The 5th BPVN dug in on the hill line east of the Nam Yum River, overlooking the town of Dien Bien Phu, where Strongpoint Elion was going to be constructed later. Bijard's paratroopers covered the northern approaches and the airstrip, where Strongpoint Huguette would appear. The remaining elements of GAP-2 covered the southwestern approaches of the base until airlifted ground troops became available to relieve them. With the arrival of the 3rd Company 31st Engineering Battalion on December 4th, and the consequent relief of the lightly equipped airborne engineers, engineering work began on a larger scale. Yet it was still concentrated primarily on the infrastructure of the base itself, rather than on preparation of the valley for a prolonged defense against massive attacks. First priority was now given to covering 6,600 feet of the airstrip with American-designed PSPs, pierced steel plates, that can be fitted together like a gigantic puzzle and constitute an acceptable substitute for concrete airstrips, and to the improvement of roads and bridges within the valley itself. These tasks alone soon outstripped the capabilities of the 331st Engineers. By December 21st, 2nd Company 31st Engineers had also been airlifted into the valley. They were shortly to be followed by the whole complement of the 31st Engineering Battalion under Major André Soudra, who also became the chief engineering advisor to Colonel de Castries. By the end of December, it had become obvious that there would soon be a direct clash between the force defending Dien Bien Phu and the vastly superior and heavily armed communists. a light tank squadron was airlifted in mid-December. Since one of the tank platoons was to go 5 miles southward to Strongpoint Isabel, the engineers were given the onerous task of building bridges capable of supporting the 18-ton tanks. As a constant stream of artillery pieces and infantry units was disgorged under the Dien Bien Phu airstrip, Major Sudra began to warn his superiors of the engineering problem that was rapidly becoming insoluble. On December 26, Colonel de Castri issued an order to all units in the valley that their positions were to be fortified to resist artillery shells of 105mm caliber. The engineering manuals of every modern army have a standard answer to this problem. Two layers of wood beams, at least 6 inches in diameter, separated by 3 feet of closely packed earth, topped off by sandbags to absorb splinters. No such protecting